just going to talk. You can hear me, right? Oh, there it is. Just a couple of quick announcements this week. Tuesday is Beer and Hymns, 6:30 at the Last Chance Saloon. Even if you don't sing or drink beer, all is well. Come and join in the fun. It gets super busy, so if you actually want a seat, come at 6. Some celebration this week. Kevin and Nicole Krondike welcomed a new sweet little baby, Jethro Caleb, into their family. 4 boys strong now they are. Mike DeBlay just set up a meal train for them. If you didn't get the email that invited you into that or aren't on the Facebook page that you can access that, let Mike know, and he will get you hooked up with that. Let's bless them with some meals, so that's one less thing they have to worry about with 4 little people in their home this week and in the coming weeks. And then just one other thing. This seems especially appropriate today in light of events this week in Charlottesville. There is a group from the branch that's getting together and going through a 9-month-long cultural agility training. And it is specifically designed to figure out specific next steps for the branch as a church. It's learning, yes, but it is also what can we do? There is so much to be done, and what is our specific part in that? There are a few people already that committed to going to that. All the details are in your bulletin. The dates and times are in there. It's a meeting once a month, every other month, I believe, but it's an all-day thing, and they ask that you commit to every single one of those. So if this is something that speaks to your heart, that weighs heavily on your heart when things like the events of this week happen, let me know, let Chris know, one of the stewards, and we'll get you plugged into that group as well. Okay? All right. Now we'll let Chris talk.
You're very kind. You may regret it, but you're very kind. Try not to do that. Well, hey, everybody. There's a picture of CJ, because I pulled one down, and the kid's adorable. So, again, encourage you to sign up to bring a meal to them. We're doing a series this whole month of August. We really did it in June as well, and then I got to the end of those 3 weeks and felt like, you know, there's some more things that have been on my heart and mind, things that I think God tried to get me to pay attention to while I was on sabbatical, and so I'm continuing to share stories from that time. Hopefully you're not tired of it yet. If you are, there's coffee out in the cafe. Today, we're going to get started by looking at a passage from Luke 23, and this may be familiar to you. In fact, I bet you've heard bits or pieces of it along the way, but let me just read this, and then we'll go from there. This is Luke 23, verse 32 down to 46. Two others, both criminals, were led out to be executed with him. This is with Jesus. When they came to a place called the Skull, they nailed him to the cross. And the criminals were also crucified, one on his right and one on his left. Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they are doing." And the soldiers gambled for his clothes by throwing dice. The crowd watched, and the leaders scoffed. "He saved others," they said. "Let him save himself, if he's really God's Messiah, the chosen one." The soldiers mocked him too by offering him a drink of sour wine. They called out to him, "Hey, if you're the king of the Jews, save yourself." The sign was fastened above him with these words, "This is the King of the Jews." One of the criminals hanging beside him scoffed, "So you're the Messiah, huh? Prove it by saving yourself and us too while you're at it." But the other criminal protested, "Don't you fear God, even when you have been sentenced to die? We deserve to die for our crimes, but this man hasn't done anything wrong." Then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And Jesus replied, "I assure you today you will be with me in paradise." By this time it was noon, and darkness fell across the whole land until 3 o'clock. The light from the sun was gone, and suddenly the curtain in the sanctuary of the temple was torn down the middle. Then Jesus shouted, "Father, I entrust my spirit into your hands." And with those words, he breathed his last. If you're wondering, have you time traveled and is it Easter season? No, it's not. We normally read this at that, this passage at that time of the year, but I hope it will be meaningful today. I don't think I need to try and convince you that the world is a broken place, do I? That the world is not as it should be. Government is ineffective. Oppression runs rampant. We remain obsessed with the Kardashians. I mean, things are not as they should be. But it's not just the world, is it? It's you and I. We're well aware of the way that our lives miss the mark. We know pain and disappointment and loss. We've all made mistakes. We've all been hurt by the mistakes of others. We're not unfamiliar with pain and brokenness. And so I think as we live in this world, as we try and be faithful throughout our lives, one question we have to ask is this: how will I respond to pain and brokenness? How will I respond to pain and brokenness? To the hurt, to the disappointment, to the loss that is all around me. How will I respond? Well, I think quite commonly our strategy is avoidance. You know what I'm talking about here? When disappointment or loss or hurt comes into our lives, and they do come, a very common response that we have as human beings is to do whatever we can to avoid the pain. Instead of embracing it, we evade it. Unfortunately, the problem with that is that avoidance doesn't do anything good for us or the world. It doesn't change anything, doesn't bring closure, there's no transformation in our lives, and yet it is such a tempting path to take, to avoid the pain and the hurt and the loss and the disappointment. I think usually to avoid those things, we will take one of two tracks. We'll either deflect or deny pain. See if you can resonate with any of these statements. You ever said anything like this? Hey, you are to blame. You're the reason for my pain, or the pain in my family, or the pain in the world. You over there somewhere are the problem. I'm not the problem. You're the problem. I'm right. I'm put together. You are wrong and a mess. And if you would just stop being such a fill in the blank, then things would be good again and the world would be right, right? We take our pain, our loss, our disappointment, and we deflect it, or we deflect the pain and loss and disappointment we see in the world, and we put it on somebody else over there. Richard Rohr says that the reason we do this is because it's a lot easier than dealing with the pain ourselves, the pain that's in us. He's a Franciscan friar, and I think he's right on this. We're tempted to deflect and project our problems, our hurt, instead of dealing with what's in us. And so when we break up with somebody, when a relationship ends, what do we sometimes feel tempted to do? We put all of the blame on that person who we've broken up with, right? They're the problem. They're the one who has the issue. And if they had just had their act together, we would have been able to live happily ever after. But they're the problem, Or we have a conflict at work, and we don't take any responsibility for the conflict. It's, again, the problem of the person over there. They're the one at fault. They're the one who's broken. Or we have a fight with someone we love. You ever had this happen where someone names out loud a way that you have hurt them or something that you've done wrong? You can nod your head because I know you have. You've been in the room with someone when they've spoken out loud something that you've done wrong, some way that you've hurt them, and you know how hard it is to be in the room at that moment, isn't it? Because what's happened, your brokenness is now like, it's been made public, at least with this other, it's been spoken out loud, it is in the room, yeah? And not only that, but you probably have to come to grips a little bit with your, I don't know, the mess that you are inside, you know, the junk that you're bringing along. There it is out in the open, and that is hard to hold on to, isn't it? Ever been tempted in that moment to do something like this? Oh, yeah? Oh, yeah? Oh, well, I'll tell you, you're a real terrible person. I remember what you did last week. That hurt me. That hurt. I've not recovered, and I don't know how you could have done that to me all that time ago, right? We deflect. We play the victim, a form of deflection and avoidance, right? So we deflect our pain or the pain we see in the world, or we deny it. We pretend that it isn't there. We bury our heads in the sand, and boy, over the course of my life, I've figured out how to do this really well, because I'm someone who likes to make peace. I like to keep things steady and level. I don't want to rock the boat. And so even if you've done something to hurt me, I'm likely to deny that pain, to pretend that nothing really happened. You know, I'll have a bad day at work, a really bad day, come home and walk through the door, and it's all over my face and my body. It's very clear I'm not in a good place. And Bethany will ask me, hey, what's wrong? A very common response for me is nothing, you know. Or when I've had a tough week and a friend comes and says, hey, is there anything I can do for you? Nothing, you know. Or a coworker sees that I just got beat up in a meeting and they ask me how I'm feeling, you know, and I will say nothing. We do our best to deny that any part of us or that something out in the world is actually broken or hurting or at a loss. And so we just put our heads down and we press on. We don't name it. We don't acknowledge it. We deny. Now, I can't help but think that this is what is happening in the passage we read earlier. Where are we in that passage? Like, geographically, where are we at that moment in Luke? He tells us we're at this place called the skull. Guys, this is not a happy place, okay? This is a place where people go to die and be killed quite gruesomely. This is not a happy place. It's the skull. And there, I've got to imagine, it's a place of pain and loss. Even if you're on the winning side, like the religious leaders are, who've kind of won the day, you know, they've gotten what they've wanted, it's still a place of incredible pain and brokenness. And do you notice what the religious leaders do in this passage? I would suggest to you they deflect and deny. They take all of that pain and brokenness, what's out there in the world and what's going on in them, and they cast it onto Jesus. Now, it's in the form of mockery. But isn't this what a schoolyard bully does with his or her pain? They cast it, they deflect it onto somebody else, often in the form of, again, mockery, right? So here you have these religious leaders. They're not looking internally at all. There's no introspection happening. They're not examining their lives. In fact, Jesus calls them at one point in the Gospels what? Whitewashed tombs. They look really good on the outside, but inside they are dead. They're not doing any internal soul-searching work. So the religious leaders are, I would argue, deflecting and denying. I think maybe perhaps even one of the criminals on one side of Jesus is doing this. Do you notice what he does? This dude is nailed to a cross. He is dying, and he chooses to use his final energy to mock Jesus as well. Yeah, hey, you know, why don't you rescue the rest of us while you're rescuing yourself? You know, he just like throws this jab in there. There's no examining of his own life. There's no acknowledgement of the pain that's present in this moment. It's just something very different. I think maybe we're something like these folks here on the skull on Golgotha. We deny, we deflect. But did you notice that there's another criminal in this story? And did you notice what he does? He says, "Hey, man, you who's mocking Jesus, knock it off. Don't you know what we've done? We deserve death." This is a guy who, to some extent, we don't know much, but to some extent, he's done some introspective soul-searching work. He's come face to face. He's wrestled with his brokenness and the actions he's taken that have led him to be nailed to a cross. And he's come to acknowledge what it means for his life. These two criminals are stark comparisons to one another, right? And Jesus seems to say, "Hey, you've done the right work here. You have had a change of your heart." Jesus acknowledges that criminal positively, says, "You'll be with me in paradise today." Now, we can talk about what that means another time. But I think at the very least for this moment today to say that, wow, there are two different ways that these criminals seem to be handling the moment. And one of them Jesus acknowledges as being on the right track. And then, of course, you have Jesus himself in this moment. What does he do with all of the pain and the loss and the brokenness and the disappointment and the betrayal? What does he do with all of that? Well, one thing he does is he utters these words, which you've heard them before, but try and hear them with fresh ears again. As he was being nailed to the cross and his things were being gambled over, he said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they are doing." Jesus doesn't deflect the pain. He doesn't point out the errors of the religious leaders. This would be a very understandable thing to do, to kind of discredit and humiliate the people who are having him crucified, to highlight their sin. He could have done any of those things in that moment with those words, but he doesn't. He takes their hate and their anger and their brokenness, and he holds it, and he transforms it, and he forgives. Richard Rohr says this about this moment. He says, "On the cross, Jesus receives our hatred and does not return it. Nor does he play the victim for his own empowerment. We find no self-pity or resentment in Jesus. He never asks his followers to avenge his murder. He suffers and does not make others suffer because of it. He does not use his suffering and death as power over others to punish them, but as power for others to transform them." Whew. Jesus goes to the cross willingly, albeit with some hesitation and some questioning along the way in Gethsemane. But in the end, he goes willingly, and he holds the pain of the world. He does not give it back. Does not deflect it back at us, nor does he deny that it's there. He holds it. He receives it. He embraces it. And by doing so, that pain and that loss and that brokenness, it gets transformed. Death becomes life. Maybe this is why James says this in chapter 1. Of his book, right out of the gate, James says, consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, brokenness, disappointment, loss, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance, and let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. Do you want to grow up, James says? Do you want to develop and become more mature? Well, it's going to require you not denying or deflecting the pain and loss and disappointment and hardship of your life. It will mean you receiving it willingly, embracing it, even considering it joy. Anybody here not think the gospel's radical? Hopefully you're maybe shifting your thinking if you're not sure about that. This is not what we usually do. But this is the example Jesus gives to us. He receives on the cross, his arms outspread. He receives all of our pain and brokenness and loss and disappointment. And as he receives it and holds it, he transforms it. From death to life, from hopelessness to hope. So this series we're in is called Stories from Sabbatical. If I can, I'd like to share a story from sabbatical. Can I do that? I have the microphone. I guess it's happening. So in April, I went to the Grand Rapids City Commission meeting. I had never been to one of these before. Couldn't have told you where they happened, when they happened. I knew nothing about them. And I imagine that's true for most Grand Rapids residents. Probably most of us have not been to one. But on this particular night, there were hundreds of people packed into the room. I mean, sitting on the floors and shoulder to shoulder in the entranceways and then out into the hallway and watching it on closed-circuit television. It was a packed house. Why? Well, every city commission meeting, at the end, there's time for open public comment on anything. It can be on anything. It doesn't even have to be on something on the agenda. You just come and make a comment about anything, and everyone gets 3 minutes to do that. And all of these people had come because a couple of weeks prior, there were five 12 to 14-year-old African-American boys who were walking home from the Croc Center. They just gotten done playing basketball. And someone had reported seeing some black kids walking through the neighborhood with a gun. And so the police came to respond to that report. And they pulled up on these boys and surrounded them with their cop cars and then drew their guns on these boys. Now, This is a complicated moment. How many of you are at least aware that this happened? Yep, that doesn't surprise me. Good. So you've read about it. You know how complicated it is in some sense. But it was also just a mess. And the community didn't know what to do with it other than to try and give voice to the brokenness of numerous systems that contribute to this thing happening. So I'm going to this city commission meeting, and on my way, I'm getting fairly worked up. About the systems in our world that are broken. The education system that has let these children down and countless other people of color. I'm so angry because I've been reading a book about our government's housing policies post-World War II that explicitly discriminated against people of color, giving them really no chance to get a home loan or to move out of these clearly marked redlined areas, right? So I'm angry about that and how that's contributed to this, and I'm getting worked up. And I get to the meeting, and it's packed. I'm a little late.
I can't even get into the room at first. But I can hear some of the stories of people as they get up to the microphone, and they're telling their experience of being a black person in Grand Rapids 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago, and what it was like, and how it's not all that different from today. And I'm listening to these stories, and I'm starting to find myself getting defensive. I come to the meeting angry at the systems of our world. I find myself getting defensive. Hey, you know, not all white people are like that. Hey, I didn't do any of those things that you're talking about. And so there's this strong urge in me to leave. I'm like standing out in the hallway anyway. It would not be hard to just be like, see ya, right? I'm out of here. I am uncomfortable. I don't enjoy anything about this moment. And I hear this voice, I think it's God's Spirit, say to me, stay. That's it, stay. And so I stay. And I listen to story after story, and I hear the pain and the heartache and the hopelessness. And as I stay, I'm changed. Do you notice what I was doing when I showed up at that meeting angry? Can you identify what that was? I was deflecting all of the pain and the heartache, right? The problem, that, as I had identified it, was with everybody over there or those systems out there in the world somewhere. It must be very clear. The systems in our world that lead to oppression must be named, and they must be changed. But all I was doing was putting all of it on them or on that out there. So I was deflecting to start with, and then I get into the space and I hear the stories and I'm denying. I don't have any role to play in this. I didn't do these things. I'm a really great guy. I'm all for racial equity. Hey, look, I'm here tonight. Aren't I a great white guy present in this room? I'm denying it all. As I sat there, I found myself trying my best, with God's help, to hold the pain, to embrace the brokenness, to enter into it, and to begin to ask myself, where am I broken? And how do I contribute to this? And what is God asking me to do? Now, this story of the city commission meeting is just one way in my life that I deflect and deny. Again, as I shared with you earlier, kind of jokingly, I do it when I'm fighting with my spouse. Thankfully, she's downstairs teaching children today. You know, she is not here to tell you all the stories of ways that I do this. You know, I deflect, I deny, put it all on her, I play the victim. I do it all. I'm really good at it. So we do it there. We do it at work. We do it all over the place. And so one question I do want to ask you this morning is there a spot in your life where you are deflecting or denying brokenness, pain, loss, disappointment? Is there a place where you are not acknowledging it? You're just trying to pretend like it isn't there? Or are you deflecting all of the blame and all of the attention onto someone or something else? And you're not doing the hard work of looking at yourself and asking, how am I a part of this? My story today is about racial inequity. That might not be your story. Don't like get caught up and think, oh, this sermon's all about racial inequity, although we're going to go back there again in just a moment. But what is it in your life? It might be something different. And it might be something pretty simple and seemingly small, but we all do this. We deny and we deflect. So is there any way that you're doing that today? How might we be people rooted in God's love who receive and are transformed by brokenness and pain? My wife has a, she got a graduate degree, many of you know, a master's degree in counseling, and her education was as much for me as it was for her, I think. She would come home and tell me things I desperately needed to know and understand. One of them was this phrase called sitting in the fire. This author that she had to read for school talks about how, you know, when we get to these uncomfortable moments in our lives, again, whether it's between husband and wife, brother, sister, some close friends, coworkers, we have disagreement, tension, the brokenness of life in the world kind of shows up. It's like this fire kind of erupts. You've been there and you know what this is like. And he says, in order to be changed, to experience transformation yourself and to see the situation or the relationship changed, you have to sit in the fire. We want to run away from the fire, right? We want to like deny it's there or try and, I don't know, just get as far away from it as we can. He says you have to actually choose to sit in the fire. And it's uncomfortable, as sitting in fires tend to be. And it's hard. But fire has a way of refining us. So when you sit in the fire long enough, there's time and space for some of the junk to get burned off. So I'm going to invite you to sit in the fire here for the next few minutes, because I do want to talk about Charlottesville. How many of you are aware of this story? Most of you, okay. If you don't know, on Friday there was a neo-Nazi rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. It was well announced. People knew it was going to happen. They didn't try and hide it. And so there was a counter protest to that. And yesterday, that the two groups clashed, and someone drove a car through the counter protest. There's a picture online of that happening in the moment, and there are bodies like literally in the air, being hurled by this car. There's a ton of anger, right? There's a ton of violence. The National Guard's been called in. It's a mess. And I think if you're like me, when you see a story like this, which is not the first here that we've had to deal with as Americans in the last few years, but where racial inequity shows up, we can either deflect or deny. Right? We can deny that there's really a problem. We can look at something like Charlottesville and say, just a bunch of crazy minority white nationalist neo-Nazis. It's just really not that big of a deal, or they're just some crazy fanatics. We can deny it. We can downplay it. That's an option. Or we can deflect. Maybe we can acknowledge the scenario, but we put all of the focus on like things out there. Oh, those neo-Nazis, they're such a crazy group of people. They're evil, they're terrible. Look at them, they're horrible. Or look at the systems again that have led to this moment, and we can deflect. And this morning, I want to at least invite you to consider the way of Jesus, which I think is to enter into the pain and the brokenness, to step into it, to go from Gethsemane to Golgotha, not hop off on a different path, but to step into the pain, into the brokenness, and receive it. Now, what that means for you today, I have no clue. I I imagine for some of us, we're fairly new to this conversation, actually. Maybe we need to just do some kind of basic thinking about what our role is or what this thing called white prejudice is or what implicit bias is. Maybe there's just some knowledge we need to gain. We need some learning. I think most of us at the Branch, though, are beyond that. We've talked about this before. We've even had some training on it. But I don't know what it is for you. I don't know what the next, I don't know what the response is that God might ask you to do. Here's one thing I am curious about, though. It's from a quote that popped into my mind this morning from Martin Luther King Jr. He says, "Our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter." Our lives begin to end the day that we become silent about things that matter. I wonder what it would look like to not remain silent for you. I don't know. You could post something on Facebook. That might be helpful, maybe. I don't know. Maybe there's somebody you need to talk to, a coworker who's black, and who you could take the courageous step but say, "Can you tell me about what this means to you? Can you help me understand how you see this? Can you tell me about what's going on in this city where you live that you see?" Maybe it's showing up someplace in public and I think there will be things tonight. I'm hearing about some things, some rallies that will happen here in Grand Rapids even tonight in light of Charlottesville. And maybe taking the courageous step of actually going out into public and being seen as someone who says, "This is not who we are," would be a way to give voice to something. I don't know what it is. I really don't. Maybe no longer remaining silent would mean that you actually just confess your role in this whole big mess before God. Maybe you've never done that. But our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter. The temptation to deflect and deny, oh gosh, it's strong. You'll feel it today. Maybe you feel it right now. Like, I don't want to deal with that. Or this isn't my problem to deal with. But it's going to show up in your relationships. It's going to show up at work. And we are called to be people who choose a third way. Not fight or flight. Not deflection or denial. But we step into the brokenness, believing that God meets us there and works in us and through us to bring change, to bring transformation. Does this meal remind us of that? I think it does. Here's a reminder of God's willingness to step into the mess of our world. Body and blood, bread and cup. Tangible reminders, things we get to partake in to help cement in our minds this reality that God doesn't deny the brokenness of the world or trying to deflect it onto us. God enters into the brokenness, receives it, bears it, holds it, and transforms it through the miracle of his love. This is one of the things that we remember and we celebrate when we break bread together. God has entered the world and has changed it. So we take this bread, we pass it from person to person this morning. We say, "This is the body of Christ given for you." Maybe this morning you want to ad lib a little bit. You want to say, "This is the body of Christ given for you. for the world. This is the body of Christ given so that we might be made whole. This is the cup of blessing given so that we might be renewed, so that we might be made and brought into relationship with God. This is blessing. This is newness of life and of covenant. We share these gifts together, believing that they encourage us and they transform us and they inspire us to be God's people in the world. So friends, if you are hungry and thirsty, receive the gifts of God for the people of God. Amen. Christ's body given for you.